This is Jana G with a show of solidarity, and today we're having a live on-air panel regarding the WTO and its effects on the general public. Before we get into the introductions of the panel today, I want to review what the WTO is for those who may not be aware. I'm reading from the American Lands Alliance out of the U.S. The WTO's creation in 1995 was the most dramatic change in international trade since 1948. From 1948 to 1995, international commerce had come under GATT, the General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs. GATT was small and provisional and was not recognized in law as an international organization. It has now been replaced by the WTO. The WTO negotiating groups meet regularly to discuss specific topics, such as telecommunications or banking. However, approximately every other year, the WTO has ministerial-level meetings at which the highest-ranking ministers from each member nation attend. The ministerials have broad agendas for assessment and the reaching of new agreements. The first two ministerials were held in Singapore in 1996 and in Geneva in 98. And we just experienced the third one in Seattle under a month ago. The WTO has elevated corporate power above the sovereign powers of all nation states. WTO panels composed of non-elected trade specialists and have overturned laws affecting labor, local economies, public health, and the environment. As you can see, the issue is quite large, and to be able to cover it in one small session like an on-air panel is not exactly likely for today, but this is probably not just the beginning, but an ongoing in conversation of what the WTO, the World Trade Organization, has up its sleeve and what it's been doing already and what it plans to do in the future of the world. Today I'm happy to have Joan Russo, Saul Arbus, Terry Wolfwood, Sol, and Charlie Stymack with me here in the studio today. Saul Arbus is president of the local Victoria chapter of the Council of Canadians and the director of the National Board of Council of Canadians. Joan Russo is former lecturer here at UVic in Environmental Studies, a federal leader of the Green Party, and has wrote a book for the International Women's Conference called The Charter of Obligations. Terry Wolfwood is a peace and social justice activist here in Victoria and director of the Barnard Boker Center Foundation, as well as a writer, speaker, and researcher on global and local issues. Sol is a student and activist involved in Victoria community as board member of the Fernwood Community Association, a coordinator of Kamasia Learning Center for Sustainable Living, as well as being a member of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. And Charlie Stymack is a former Vietnam War resister from Detroit, Michigan, who moved to Canada in opposition to that war. He's been active in the steelworkers and auto workers unions and has graduated from Trent University and the University of Victoria. Thanks, everyone, for being here. I appreciate it. We'll start today's panel with kind of an brief introduction from everyone talking about their specific issues regarding the WTO, because it is so massively huge, ranging from food safety to intellectual property rights to, oh my God, it goes on. I mean, they talk about international trade, but it's much, much more from more than that. Agriculture, the list goes on. And we'll start today with each person talking about their specific interest, either, you know, in a specific manner, or you can be an overview if you prefer to speak from a bigger picture perspective. And the first question being, from your perspective, Saul, how would and your outlook on the World Trade Organization, how do you see this WTO affecting the general public?
First of all, I'd like to say that we have just come through an enormous victory for civil society in terms of stopping the WTO in its tracks in Seattle. No new agreements were signed there. As late as Thursday of the Friday before they collapsed, the U.S. Trade Representative was speaking optimistically about consummating an agreement and which had failed by the end of the process. And this was thanks to the tremendous organization in terms of the direct action that was carried out there and the number of marches that occurred, and also the deliberations of civil society and all the issues that the World Trade Organization was considering, which took place in a number of forums every day during the entire period of the meetings of Seattle, really beginning the Friday before and going through the Friday next. So for 8 days, there was consideration in very large forums of the implications of the WTO and effective measures to stop it. And as usual in these meetings, whether it be APEC or the WTO, there was massive police violence, violation of human rights, arbitrary detention, use of chemical agents to disperse the crowds, mostly unsuccessfully. And even in terms of the modest amount of violence that occurred in terms of window breaking, as Maude Barlow put it, of the Council of Canadians, these people too were expressing their frustration and anger at feeling excluded from the deliberations that would have very great implications for them in their own lives. The WTO, because of the insidious nature of the enforceable trade rules, is able to seep into every aspect of every nation state in terms of overthrowing its laws if they are seen to be trade restrictive or WTO incompatible. And this has already happened in the first 5 years of the WTO in a whole number of areas in which environmental, social, and health and labor standards have been collapsed by compliant nation states. In fact, every nation state in the WTO, every nation state every 2 years must bring before the WTO all of its areas which could be considered to be trade restrictive and indicate the measure it's the measures it has taken to comply with the WTO trade and investment rules. Now, there are a whole number of agreements, and I'm not going to regale your members with all of those agreements today. There are just too many areas. I think there's something like 17 or 18 different areas within the WTO, 17 different treaties or agreements. And but I will indicate one other way in which is very different than the GATT, quite apart from the enforceable rules, is that it is going also into investment. And aspects of the MAI have already been completed through the trade-related investment measures, or TRIMS, agreement. And there was a move, as you probably know, to increase the regime under investment to protect investor rights, which generally means the interests of transnational corporations over nation states, of which the MAI was the initial model. Now, while I was in Seattle, I had a particular interest. In June of this year, I joined the Forests and Globalization International Working Group, which represented something like 50 activists from around the world who met originally in the who were meeting through the internet for a long time before that, but we met face to face in June because there is one area that was to be negotiated in Seattle which very few people actually were aware of. And this is known as the Accelerated Tariff Liberalization. The Accelerated Tariff Liberalization, or ATL, referred to 8 priority areas brought forward by, yes, you remember APEC? The APEC ministers brought forward 8 areas for priority consideration to be signed off in Seattle to create framework agreements on 8 areas, and 2 of those areas were forests and fisheries. Our particular area, as I said, was in forestry. The original plan was to sign off an agreement in Seattle, which for developed countries would mean that there would be the elimination of all tariffs on forest products beginning in the year 2000. And for, I'm hesitating here because we say developing nations, but many of these nations are de-developing, in fact. I think this term came from Terry Wolfwood. But the third world countries, not a satisfactory term either, were given to something like 2003 to 2004 to comply. Now, tariffs is one area, but the other area that has to be remembered always is what is known as non-tariff measures or technical barriers to trade. And this is what you and I call environmental regulation, labor standards, health standards, social standards. All of these can be challenged as trade restrictive. What this would mean is that we would not be able to have eco certification of wood because the WTO is not concerned with how a product is produced, only the end product. We would have a very grave risk of invasive species entering our forests, which after habitat loss are the greatest source of devastation of our forests. And it would mean green procurement rules, for example, would be out the window. In other words, this would have been a devastating agreement for forests and leading to about a 4 to 5% increase in logging of primary forests worldwide. By way of conclusion, however, that agreement collapsed, along with all other agreements in Seattle, giving forest activists around the world some breathing space in order to continue to work to utterly defeat that agreement.
Thank you, Saul. Joan, would you like to carry on?
Yes, I think that we have to recognize that even if the WTO wasn't around, we'd still have the problem because right now governments around the world are devolving their power to corporations. This has been happening over a long period of time. I've noticed it particularly at the United Nations level where suddenly I meet when I go to the international meetings NGOs from the pulp and paper industry, for example. So we've got all sorts of industry moving into the international sphere through the UN. I felt that there was a really strong message there against the WTO, but there was not a strong enough message about how we should deliver this message. And I felt quite disappointed, actually, because I had wanted everyone to say with a strong voice that the WTO should be dismantled, along with, I would have liked to have heard as well, NATO should be dismantled, and that we should instead call upon governments to live up to their international agreements in other areas, such as guaranteeing human rights, including labor rights, protecting the environment, ensuring social justice, providing socially, equitable, and environmentally sound employment, and preventing war and conflict. So I would have liked to have seen a strong, unified message, not only against the WTO, because I found there was a lot of division. There would be people who were saying, well, let's speak out against the WTO, calling for the dismantling of the WTO, and other groups saying, well, why don't we just tinker here and there, add a little labor here, a little environment, and so forth. And I felt that was rather an unfortunate approach, because what it does is give, to a certain extent, the WTO even more power, because if the WTO had power over environmental agreements as well, over labor agreements, that would undermine international agreements in the environmental field, international agreements in the labor field, and certainly international agreements in the human rights field. Another thing that I found a bit disconcerting was that I felt that there was too much emphasis on sovereignty. And it has been over the years disturbing to place too much importance in sovereignty without some overarching international principles. And I didn't hear this coming out a lot in the dialogue. People would say, well, the solution is complete decentralization and control at the local level, the democratic processes at the local level. Now, I feel that this is a very important and strong message to get across, particularly when you have trade agreements like the WTO, which is a vested interest economic international agreement, in contrast to the ones I was mentioning before, which I describe as public trust agreements, you know, human rights, peace, environment, social justice, and labor rights. And I think at this stage in global development, I think we do need some overarching principles. And I would have liked to have heard more people at the public meetings saying, what we need is democratic control at the local level, but within a framework of overarching public trust principles. And I feel that there were two sort of different positions being taken. One is, let's try to work within the WTO. And there were a lot of people that were actually in the conference. A lot of activists were in there, and they were trying to work with the governments, trying to come up. Some were just there as observers, but others were there at the table trying to introduce more regulations, which would give some legitimacy, I feel, to the WTO. Then we had another group that was saying that, we don't want any international control whatsoever. We don't want any international models. We want to just have decentralization control at the local level. And so I was sort of taking an in-between position where I said what we need is to have a strong voice calling for the dismantling of the WTO, and at the same time giving support to the international agreements that are already in place. And as you mentioned, I wrote a book on the Charter of Obligations, and I know what governments have agreed to, and they've agreed to many things that would completely override the WTO. I think what has happened is that a lot of opponents of the WTO do not know about these other international agreements. They don't know that we've got a lot to already work with. And I'm sorry that that didn't come out a bit more. But I was very pleased to see this united front against the WTO. But as I said, I was disappointed that the strategies for dealing with it seemed to be different. I also want to clarify the term civil society, because I have heard it misused over and over again. And even within one UN institution, such as the United Nations Development Program, UNDP, I heard one person from the UNDP say there are three categories: civil society, market, and the state. And then I heard someone else from UNDP saying there are two categories, the state and civil society. And there was a strong move by corporations to become part of civil society, because they define civil society as being non-governmental. So I think when we speak about civil society, we have to be very clear that we're speaking about civil society that is promoting what I refer to as the public trust. I felt that there's been generally in Canada a very strong movement against the trade agreements that I feel is a very nationalistic, sovereignty-oriented movement, which doesn't sufficiently indicate that Canada is the villain as well as the victim. And that was something I was really interested in bringing out when I was there, because Canada, I was at one session where they were talking about asbestos and how Canada is trying to set aside the banning of asbestos. France has a ban on asbestos now, and Canada wants to sell it to the developing countries. And also Canada is a villain in relation to genetically engineered foods and crops. And I worked with a group of 130 biotechnology activists from around the world, and we came up with a very strong statement calling for a global ban on the patenting of living organisms and their parts, a ban on genetically engineered foods, processes, crops, and animals, and the criminalization of biopiracy and the stealing of indigenous genes and knowledge of farmers, peasants, and indigenous peoples, and to establish strict corporate liability for all economic loss and personal injury resulting from genetically engineered crops and food. And then we concluded with a very positive call for intensifying global campaigns for promoting organic agriculture and other forms of ecological farming. So I was following that all the way through, and I did speak to Maxime Waters, who was a very powerful congresswoman from the States, who said that she would put this resolution on the floor of Congress. And I hope she does, because if she puts it forward, people listen to her. And
Great. Well, I think, thank you, Joan. I think it's true that we have to pressure our politicians, whether they're in the U.S. or Canada, Mexico, or, you know, other in the European Union. These issues are of utmost importance. Terry, would you like to carry on?
Well, we've heard a great deal about the World Trade Organization and it's supposed to be about trade. But there are aspects of it which relate very closely to militarization. And I should say that one of the first examples of that is what happened in Seattle. People were meeting in churches, in basements, in meeting rooms all over. They were nonviolent protesters in the street. They were not just protesters. They were activists who were working for a just world. And they were demonstrating nonviolently when suddenly Seattle became militarized. They called out the police. They called out the National Guard. They called out the state police. And I had an email today which said that there were several hundred special troops from the U.S. military in Seattle the whole time in plain clothes from both the Navy, the Air Force, and the Army. And they were these were special troops designed to work in things like explosives, to work in gas, to work in people control. And they were there as advisors and active participants in the actions, but they were all in plain clothes. There was a small amount of property destruction in Seattle, and I firmly believe that probably most of that was done by agents provocateurs and people who were paid. I stood beside the Nike Town building and watched the porch of Nike Town being disassembled by people on the roof and saw that the police did nothing. But the police saved themselves to act against people who were nonviolent, who were extremely articulate in knowing that the World Trade Organization had done things to damage the environment, to damage environment and human rights all over the world. And these people were very clear. And what happened was that they became the victims of militarization. And it was a militarization which the rest of the world, the majority world, has suffered for the last decades. In fact, America came home. The American military came home in a big way in Seattle. And what happened in Seattle is what we have seen in Guatemala, in Indonesia, in Angola, in Iraq, all over the world. The U.S. military have been using their power to enforce not only trade agreements, but mainly the open market system to make the world safe for corporate control. And so there's a very close connection between militarization and globalization and global trade. When we hear about the various categories of trade that were to be discussed and agreed on at the WTO, and agreement wasn't reached, but no doubt in other meetings there will be agreements reached, but reference has been made, for instance, to agriculture, to forestry, and to fisheries. Well, there's one category of trade which is never mentioned in trade discussions. It's called an exemption under the North America Free Trade Organization, which is very much the blueprint for what the MAI was to be and what was further to come about in the World Trade Organization. Under NAFTA, there is one major exemption in trade that is not restricted in any way, and every government in every country can do what they like in this particular category of trade, and that is the arms trade. Mm-hmm. We can subsidize arms manufacturers. We can trade as and wish where we like. We can have a closed trade. We can have special agreements. Just recently, Canada brought in yet another major budget in supporting the defense industry, and that's they put on trade fairs and they go on junkets around the world to promote Canada's arms sales. There are also major subsidies by the Canadian government for arms manufacture at many levels. Now, Canada professes not to be a big arms exporter, particularly to the majority world. But the fact of the matter is that most of the military equipment, and that's not just arms, but that includes things like helicopters, trucks, all kinds of stuff, motors, engines, most of what we produce goes to the United States. And from the United States, it is either a part or whole of weapon systems and military support that's offered, for instance, to the military government in Colombia, which right now is heating up tremendously. And the United States military are active in Colombia, and we don't know what kind of things that have been manufactured in Canada are part of that, because we can't find out where things that we export to the U.S. go. So that's one of the examples of militarization. And I'd just like to close to say that there's another much more subtle form of militarization connected with globalization. And that is, globalization is bringing on the world over, and we've certainly seen it specifically in Mexico since NAFTA, a growing gulf between the rich and the poor, and that the poor are increasing in number and they're increasing in poverty. And the governments all over the world are responding to the demands and the discontent and the desperation of their poor by increasing militarization within their own countries.
Thank you, Terry Wolfwood. Briefly, I just want to say, for those who want to read more about the interconnection between globalization, militarization, and poverty, Michel Shostakovsky has written a book. He's an economist professor from the University of Ottawa, called The Globalization of Poverty. And with his case studies and so on and so forth, he points out these insidious connections that mainstream media and other people have yet to really talk about. And I appreciate the connection of this militarization along with growing poverty worldwide. Sol, how are you doing over there?
Not too bad.
Okay. What would you like to say for today?
Well, I guess I just wanted to go on what Terry was saying, you know, about what happened in Seattle. I think that just really shows that what's wrong with the WTO, that if a system has to be maintained by force, be it military or police repression or massive state and corporate propaganda, then it's obviously not true progress or democracy or anything positive. And I was down in Seattle for a week for the mass direct actions in the street and around the convention center and at the jail. And we were, like those of us who were doing direct action, were calling for the dismantling of the WTO and an end to corporate domination. And just to really illustrate that the WTO, it's not just about the World Trade Organization, that this is just the biggest representation of capitalism and corporate domination that's destroying our communities, and just that it's about the loss of individual and community autonomy and our ability to meet our own needs and to live healthy and sustainably. I was there because I believe that in whatever we do, we should always be trying to create a better world, a world in which, you know, everyone's able to meet their basic needs and can fully grow and develop as individuals, and where everyone has an equal say in all decisions that affect their lives, where everyone has personal autonomy and freedom from authoritarian control. And the WTO and the kind of progress it purports to create is the complete opposite of that vision. The WTO and then this kind of economy is about, they say that it's about free trade, but really it's trade that's free from regulations around labor, free from regulations around the environment or human rights, free from competition by eliminating all the small and medium-sized businesses and making it virtually impossible for them to survive, and that any regulation we currently have or make in the future at the municipal, provincial, or federal level may be seen as a limitation to business. And it's about an economy that's based on export, with local people not being able to meet their own basic needs. So, you know, farmers can be, you know, growing all this food and then shipping it off and not being, you know, not even having enough to eat themselves. So, and also just to say that the international trade that the WTO, you know, the World Trade Organization is supposedly talking about is not about trade at all. For one corporation which owns everything from production to consumption, to send its products along its own international assembly line, you know, dropping off a few pennies to workers along the way is a misuse of the term trade. It's no longer about one country trading its bananas for the apples produced in another country, or even for dollars or direct investment. It's all about creating an economy that's completely governed by multinational corporations. That's why I was in Seattle, and I think why a lot of people are in Seattle is just to speak out against the World Trade Organization and everything that's already happening with global capitalism and what it's doing to our communities. You know, my best friend is forced to eat white bread right now, from a food bank because he can't find work. You know, so.
Thank you, Saul. Now, Charlie, what would you like to say about the WTO and its effect on the people?
Yeah, basically, what really intrigued me in relationship to the World Trade Organization is its attack on popular democratic rights of the people. And what really struck me concretely was the similarity between the use of the police during the WTO and the use of the police and army in Detroit in 1967. Hmm. In 67, the 82nd Airborne and the 101st Air Cavalry were brought back from Vietnam to take one half of the city during the uprising. And the National Guard and police took the other half. And what I saw in Seattle was the direct use of organized military columns of police in attacking the protesters and attacking people's right to express their point of view publicly on the streets or within other gatherings, whether it be on the Capitol Hill of Seattle or in front of the World Trade Organization's meetings. John Locke, in 1690, in his two treatises on government, established as a firm principle of the democratic rights of the people to resist and not just war or to express themselves publicly. And although he was part of the Whig anti-monarchist faction within the British Parliament, set the stage for the revolutions within the American colonies or within France's revolution in 1780s. So what we are essentially battling with is a basic democratic right of the population to express itself. And that was trampled on in Seattle by the stormtroopers of the police forces of Seattle and the counties and the National Guards and undercover other military forms. And so we're engaged actually in a global struggle around democratic rule or corporate rule. And one of the slogans said during the demonstration by the demonstrators was, "This is what democracy looks like." And whether that struggle be in Eastern Europe or North America or Africa against apartheid or within any third world country or a country of the non-multinational corporate world is regaining democratic rule. And that's a long fight and a long process a struggle by the population. And it's interesting to note how theoretically it's been a point of discussion within the world's governmental forms for centuries. It's not something new to our experience, but something that's of a very, very deep character. And Seattle was an expression of that by the population, not only of Seattle, but all over the West Coast. And I met people who had traveled all the way from Chicago to take part in the demonstrations. There were many others from California, Oregon, and throughout Washington, and BC. And the protests that are being outlined by Jenna G, that she pointed out earlier in the program, in Chicago, in Washington, and other centers, and hopefully in Vancouver, are part of what's a very long struggle and a very international one. And it strikes me as ironic that we yell about democracy in Eastern Europe when in truth the battle for democracy is endemic to our situation across the Western world. And I think it was, I'm trying to remember, but someone pointed out that the struggle for liberty is unending.